Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Continuing in our study in Ecclesiastes, which I think is one of the most contemporary applicable books in our day that says a real word to the arrogance of our time as far as its intelligence and its ability to solve problems. I hope you'll turn with me in your Bible to Ecclesiastes chapter 8. I'm going to be breaking into the context about verse 16 and then covering most of 9 and jumping to 11. It says, When I gave my heart to know wisdom. Now, the author has emphasized wisdom as a very appropriate way of trying to find God in life. The author himself has sought wisdom. But he wants to say of wisdom that having wisdom is better than not having wisdom. But wisdom itself, as prized as it was in Israel, as these wisdom literature shows, is not an ultimate. The ultimate is God. Wisdom can take you just far, so far, and no further. So it continues. When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on earth, even though one should never sleep day and night. You know, I forgot if I met somebody or read it, it's been so long ago, who really wanted to read every book that was written. But they added up the number of books written every year, the number of books that have already been written, how fast they could read, how many days they'd possibly lived, and realized they could not know all the knowledge. As fast as knowledge is growing in our day, it's even more true than the day of Coley. It is impossible to know all areas of human knowledge. Even in one given area, it's impossible. So what he's trying to say is, I could read for the rest of my life. I could not sleep night or day, and it still would not be possible for me to master all accumulated human wisdom, much less the wisdom of God. Then he continues, and I saw every work of God, and I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Well, this whole aspect of verse 17 talks about discovery. This is what it says. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover. You know, there's two ways of talking about knowledge. The arrogance of our modern scientific culture is, if we have more knowledge, if we just had more time for research, we could solve every problem of man. That's simply not the case. For the ultimate knowledge is not how things work, cause and effect. The ultimate knowledge is who put that cause and effect into place. Knowledge can take us back to point A, but only God can bring us beyond point A and the meaning of life. So what it's saying is that man cannot discover true knowledge. And that's very true. The Bible is unique in the fact that it is not man discovering God by empirical means. It is man being shown who God is. The Bible is revelation. God disclosing himself to man, not man discovering God. There are two passages in New Testament I think are very appropriate. Romans 11:23, 1 Corinthians 1:18 through 25. We cannot discover God. One of the things that has caused Ecclesiastes to cause many people problems is the fact that it says right up front, you cannot know God. Now, we must understand that in the way the author is using it. Ultimate knowledge is not available to man. Man cannot know ultimately about God or even about himself. But God has revealed some things about himself, and man can know some things about God. And the author's conclusion is, what we do know about God enables us to trust him and keep his commands. It's going to be the conclusion of chapter 12. And I think that's what it's saying here. Now, in chapter 19, for I have taken all this to my heart and explain it, that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. God is involved in the life of godly men and women. But what's going to shock us, and what shocked the rabbis that have struggled with this book for years, is that the fate of the righteous man and the fate of the wicked do not always reflect God's presence and love for one and judgment on the other. What it's trying to say is God is sovereign in life. But quite often, the good die young and the wicked prosper. You see, Ecclesiastes is really struggling with the same Old Testament theology that caused the reaction that is seen so evident in the book of Job and Psalm 73, and is right here in chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes. Sometimes the best people God has find themselves in terrible circumstances, and sometimes the most evil people live lives of prosperity and abundance. Now, that was difficult for this author to understand and to put down. So he's going to try to pin it the best he can to try to help us see if we love God and we're living for Him, no matter what the circumstances are, God's going to work it out. And let's go through this again if we could. Notice it says, man does not know that whether it be love or hatred, anything awaits him. What that's saying is, just because you're a godly man doesn't mean you're going to be prosperous. Now, that is the initial theology of the Old Testament. If God loves you, you won't have leprosy. If God loves you, you're going to be physically prosperous. But then there came a man like Job. Then there came the reaction of David in Psalm 73. And added to that is the struggle of the author of Ecclesiastes. He said, look, you can be a godly, righteous man, but you still don't know if tomorrow is going to be a good day, or if you're going to have health, or if you're going to have abundance, or if you're going to have sickness and tragedy. Now, he continues then. It is the same for all. There is one fate for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good, for the clean, for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice and for the one who doesn't offer sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. Now, what he's trying to do is just cover the all aspects of life. He's putting ceremonial cleanliness and those who would swear an oath to God of allegiance. On the other side, those who are unclean and those who refuse to swear. What he's trying to say is, when you look at all men, if I could put it contemporaneously, the good, bad, and the ugly, they all have problems. They all face similar trials. They all seem to involve in somewhat of a fickleness of fate, if you just look at it, humanly speaking. Now, let's continue then. When it says, in this deal about the swear and those who don't swear, the Bible never says that we have to take an oath. But if we do swear in God's name, the Bible says we ought to keep it. You're not asked to swear, but if you do swear, make sure you perform that oath. Now, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun. Now, there's that key phrase. My friends, if you miss that key phrase, there's no hope of you accurately interpreting the book of Ecclesiastes. This book is absolutely diametrically opposed to most Old Testament and New Testament theology. If you do not see this writer is speaking tongue in cheek, he's looking at life from two perspectives. Life without God, there's no hope. It's miserable. It's fickle. It's fate. All are going to die. There's no advantage to anybody. All is vanity of vanities. But if you bring God into the system, there's not a whole lot of light. There's not a whole lot of understanding, but there is a perspective of faith that says life is good, though there still may be problems. I can trust God even though I can't know Him fully. I can trust God, He is sovereign, even though there may come bad circumstance in my life. And that's what the author is saying, especially this little phrase, what is done under the sun. Now, that there is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the heart of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. This is an emphasis on theology, I think, of the pervasive effects of the fall. All men have been affected by sin. And I do believe in the Reformation principle of total depravity when understood. It doesn't mean that man is as bad as he can possibly be. It simply means that every aspect of man's life has been affected by sin. Those who love God and trust God are still affected by sin. That evil intent, the rabbis would call it the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse is in all men. Now, when it mentions this deal about one fate involves all, it's talking about death. It's not saying, we're not even bringing the afterlife into the discussion here. It's just saying, you know and I know, friends, that everybody's going to die. The good dies, the evil dies. Everybody dies. Everything dies. That's the common experience of fallen man. Now, it mentions here, insanity is in the heart throughout their lives. You might want to see Genesis 6:5, where it says that man's heart is on evil continually. And that's why God sent the flood. But unfortunately, the evil propensity of man was in Noah. We see right after the flood, he offers a sacrifice, and then he plants a vineyard and gets drunk. So that evilness pervades right on through humanity. Now, it continues then, where it mentions, "For whoever is joined with the living, there is hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion." Now, you've got to see this with chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. What it's saying is that there is a chance to respond to God and to understand God's place in our lives if you're alive. But if you're dead, there's no hope at all. So what it's saying is, whether you live with prosperity or riches, the lion was the king of the jungle. But when the king of the jungle's dead, it's better to be a mangy street mongrel that's alive than a dead king or a dead wealthy person. Now, the dogs of this day were not white poodles with painted fingernails. They were street mongrels that ran in packs. They were not domesticated. They were ugly and dirty and had mange and ticks and fleas. And it's just saying the lowest person alive is better than the greatest person dead. That's what this verse is trying to say. Now, let's look at verse 5. "For the living know they will die." And you know, there's always been a fear there. In the Old Testament, even though the Jews trusted in God, Sheol was not a pleasant place. The best that the Old Testament theology has is it's a shadowy existence. You're conscious, but you don't do anything. There's no joy. Only a little glimpse here and there in the Old Testament. Daniel 12, some of the Psalms, parts of the book of Job give that little insight. Now, then it says, "For the living know they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor do they have any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten." Now, for a Jew, memory was very important. That's why to a Jew, having children, in some sense, assured his continuing existence. There is an aspect of Old Testament theology where you live on in your posterity. But if your memory dies, or if your seed dies, you're cut off. Well, to the Orient, this memory was very important. Now, not in Israel, but in other cultures, ancestor worship was very important. And so what we have here, the author is making the strongest statement he can say. He says, you're going to die, and you're going to be forgotten, and you know, you're going to be totally cut off. And that he's trying to intensify his thought now. Don't use verse 5 as a proof text. You've got to balance it with chapter 12, verse 7. So be careful not to read. You cannot proof text this book. If you pull little verses out of this book, you're going to totally misunderstand it. The Jehovah Witnesses are very bad about proof text in this book to back up their theology. This is one book that must be read completely in one setting and the complete view applied to life, not proof texting. All right, verse 6. "Indeed, their love, their hate, their zeal have already perished. They no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun." Now, there's that little phrase. Humanly speaking, I don't care what you do in life. Humanly speaking, you can live a good life, a righteous life, a moral life. You can be wealthy. You can be poor. You can be famous. No one can know you. If all there is life, friends, when you die, it's over. I don't care how much you loved. I don't care how wealthy you are. I don't care how enthusiastic. I don't care how great your personality. If this is all there is, when you die, all you're good for is fertilizer. Now, verse 7 then, picks up a new paragraph, and it says, "So then, eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works." This is one of the major answers to Coley's theology. He says, we can't know God completely, but we can know something about God. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. We live in ignorance about what our life is going to hold. But we do know there is a God, and we do know that we can live one day at a time and enjoy the things that he's given us. What this is saying is, be content in what you have for today. If you have plenty, be content. If you have little, be content. This is a current theme of the book. Look at the number of times it's used. 224, 312 and 13, 322, 518, 612, 815 is a common, reoccurring, major theme. Sounds a lot like Paul in Philippians. I've learned to be content, whatever circumstance I'm in. whether in good circumstance and wealthy and have all I need, or in low circumstance. Friend, contentment is one of the simple joys of life that only a perspective of God's love and sovereignty and presence can give you. Koheleth is saying, look, you don't have tomorrow. You're going to die. You can't know everything about God. Wisdom is not ultimate. Enjoy what you have. Enjoy if it's a bowl of soup or if it's a 9-course dinner. Thank God. Enjoy it. Enjoy what you have. If you work for a living or if you're a wealthy person, enjoy today's labor. Enjoy today's pursuits. Enjoy today's pleasures. Thank God for them. Now it says here, for God has already approved your works. The word here means acceptable or well-pleasing. We need to accept God's acceptance for us. Sometimes we're so push oriented. We forget, even Paul in the New Testament says, strive to live quiet, gentle lives. Oh, friends, enjoy what you have. Be content. Don't always be dreaming about what you want to do tomorrow and what you wish you had and the greener grass. Be content. God is accepting you. Now, the second one is very important. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. If you got a choice of being happy or sad, what you got, why not pick happy? Why not wear the best clothes you got? Why not anoint your face with oil and be happy? Oil was a sign of festivals, religious and social. They didn't have Mary Kay, so they just wiped this oil over themselves. It just glistened in the sun. It was a sign of joy. I think this is, if we control our own destiny to some extent, in the sense not of what happens to us, not in what happens to us, but in our attitude toward what happens to us. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life. This is the idea, woman or wife. This is the wife of your youth. I want to turn back over my Bibles very quickly and just read one little passage of Proverbs 5, 18 and 19. Let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice in the wife of your youth, as a loving hind and a graceful doe. Let her breast satisfy all you all the times. Be exhilarated always with her love. Man, I hope you have a good marriage. I hope you don't look around just for somebody who you think is prettier than the woman you married, or younger than the woman you married, or has more. You picked that lady. Hopefully you prayed about it before you picked her. I hope you can rejoice all the days y'all are together as much as you rejoice in those first few years together. Well, this is a neat word to men in our day. Be content. Rejoice in what you have, not what you wish you had. This is a beautiful example, I think, of the Bible's positive view toward married sex. I don't know where the Puritan idea of this is all nasty and dirty and we shouldn't talk about it comes from. We ought to be promoting the joy of Christian married sex in our churches for couples who are married in Christ. There ought to be a joy there that we ought to be able to express in the way we love one another and continue through all the way through our lives. And this is a beautiful place to say that. Which he has given you. God is involved, hopefully, in the choosing of our marriage partner. God is involved in those major decisions of life. Under the sun, this is your reward in life, in your toil in which you have labored under the sun. Verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, verily do it with all your might. If I could put that into the New Testament, I'd say, whatever you do, do it as unto the Lord. Listen, friends, if you work with metal, you be the best worker of metal you can be. If you're a lawyer, be the best lawyer you can be. If you're a singer, be the best singer you can be. And look at the mundane things of life as service unto God, and it'll never become boring or tedious or mundane to you. It's when we do this shoddy thing. We ought to work as the people of God. You ought to look at Ephesians chapter 6, 1 and following, where it talks about slaves doing the very best job they can for their masters. Not because their masters are so good, but because they're Christian slaves. And that theme is throughout the New Testament. Now, it continues then where it says, for there is no activity or planning or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. The old guy's blunt-seeking bit. He said, look, work is good, enjoy it, Because I want to tell you, one day you ain't going to work. You might want to see John 9:4, where Jesus once said, "Let's do the works of Him while there is still light, for the night cometh when no man can work." Friends, you've got today, use today. That's what it's saying. Don't plan on tomorrow and dream for tomorrow. Use today. Because all you got is today, and one day you're not going to have any more todays. Now, it continues then, when it's Sheol, is this grave, the realm of the dead. It was a conscious existence, but a very shadowy existence. Now, again, I saw the sun, that the race is not to the swift, the battle is not to the warriors, neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to the men of ability, for time and change overtake them all. The Hebrew term here for change is to meet. You're going to come to circumcision. Look what it's saying. You see, he's saying, look, just because you're wealthy, doesn't mean you're going to be happy. Just because you're smart, doesn't mean you're going to understand. Just because you're strong physically, doesn't mean you're going to win the battle. All of us know people who should have gotten what they want out of life because of their gifts or because of what they have. They hadn't always worked that way. You're going to meet circumstances that totally flip-flop everything that should be. Our world's not a fair world. When you finally come to that, you're going to be content with what you do have instead of always doing what you don't have. If you put all your effort and all your might into trying to correct the past, which you can't affect, or affect the future, which you can't, you're never going to enjoy today. That's the emphasis. Enjoy today. Life's not fair. Enjoy what you got. It doesn't seem to always work out the way it should. Enjoy who you are, where you are, and what you do have. And there'll be a real sense of joy. Now, let's see. Okay, verse 12. Moreover, a man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. You can't control your destiny. You don't have tomorrow. Live in joy for today. That's the major thrust. Let me go to chapter 11, verses 1 through 6, to conclude our study for today. Okay, it says, "Cast your bread upon the surface of the waters, and you will find it after many days." I've heard that many times in my life. But the King James is not really a good deal about cast. It's the word here, send away. It's used in Proverbs 31:14 for send away with the purpose and view of bringing it back. Friends, we cast our bread in the water. You know, I don't know about you, I have little kids, and we go feed the ducks at the park, and we tear bread and throw it, and it gets soggy and sinks. It's not the kind of bread. This is those round loaves, hard round loaves. Friends, this was the ancient Frisbees, if you please. And they'll float a long time. Cast down the water. Now, what is it talking about here? Well, it may be talking about investment, like it is in Proverbs 31, commercial investments. Diverse your savings and your interest so that in case one thing fails, you won't lose everything. That's what verse 2 is talking about. Divide your portion to 7 and 8, for you do not know what misfortune may come upon the earth. Or it may be talking about loving deeds to other men. It may be saying, look, love other people. And chances are, when you need it, they're going to love you back. Don't love just a few. Love everybody you come in contact with. Share with all you come in contact with. When you get in a place of need, they're going to be more likely to share with you. I think that's probably what it's saying. Now, notice in verse 3, if the clouds are full and they pour out rain on the earth, and whether a tree falls toward the south or towards the north, wherever the tree falls, it lies. What's it saying? You can't control circumstances. You don't know when it rains and when it's not going to rain. When a tree falls, and the word tree here can mean stick, so it may refer to divination, not just a tree falling aimlessly in the forest. But if a tree falls, anything you do as far as what you want, can it determine if it falls this way or that way? No, trees just fall where they're going to fall. What this saying is, you don't control your own life. Your destiny is in the hands of God if you believe in God and He loves you. But if you don't take God into the system, your destiny is just the changing fortunes of fickle fate. Now, it continues then when it says, he who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Don't wait for idle conditions to do your thing. Don't say, well, if the wind doesn't blow, I'll do this. Friends, I live in Lubbock, Texas. If I waited, the wind didn't blow to do anything, I'd never do anything. Wind blows here all the time. Don't wait for the perfect day. Perfect days will never come. Do what you have to do. Don't be discouraged about doubts or fears. Well, if I plant, will it rain? Plant! Man, hope the best. Plant! Hope it'll rain. It continues. then when it says, and see, I lost my place. Got so excited. Just as you do not know the path of the wind. Now, the word wind here can mean spirit or breath, like in John 3:8, but it's probably wind. And how the bones are formed, the womb of a pregnant woman. You don't know how little babies are formed. Psalms 139, 13 through 16. But because you don't know where the wind's going to blow and how little babies are made, don't quit making little babies. Right? Exactly. Now, sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed, or whether both of them alike will be good. He's saying, Paul would say it this way, in season, out of season, preach the gospel. Well, Coley didn't use it for gospel. He's saying for normal life. If you got a chance to do good, do it. Sow in the morning, sow in the evening. You may lose one or the other. You may lose them both, but if you don't try, you'll never succeed. What he's saying, give it a shot, man. Give it a shot. You don't know. Maybe God will bless both of them. If God doesn't bless either one, it's all right. Be content with what you got. That seems to be the thrust. All the way through here is contentment with who you are. I think that's very important. I hope you'll look at 2 Corinthians 9:6 that I think fits in the last part of verse 6. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.
We hope you enjoyed today's verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study. If you would like a free outline of today's lesson, please write us at Bible Lesson, Box 1289, Marshall, Texas, 75671. Also available is a comprehensive catalog of Bob's Bible teaching and preaching ministry. It contains over 3,000 audio and video Bible study tapes on chapter-by-chapter and verse-by-verse studies on complete books of the Bible, as well as difficult and controversial subjects. The catalog is free upon request. Write us today at Bible Lesson, Box 1289, Marshall, Texas, 75671.
We're beginning again in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And I want to say a couple of things to you in the introduction time that are so crucial in a chapter like this. If you proof text chapter 7, you're going to prove some theology that the rest of the Bible totally contradicts. Now, chapter 7 is a very loose string of these Jewish pearls, if you please. They're unrelated subjects, but there is a context. There's a loose affinity between them. And if you miss that affinity, you're going to misinterpret this chapter. They are related in Hebrew parallelism. And so one phrase is going to be repeated slightly different. In this chapter, verses 2 through 5, two phrases are going to be repeated. And we must see that, or we're really going to have a poor theology of death. So let's look at this if we could. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. A good name is better than good ointment. Now, there's a play on words here. The word name is the word shem in Hebrew, and the word ointment is a variation of that. So there's a play on words. There's another one a little bit later on down in verse 6, but these plays occur and we don't see them in English. Now, what does it mean a good name is better than good ointment? Well, the real question is, what does ointment mean? It could mean a healing balm, or it could be festival makeup. Now, if it's a healing balm, it's saying a good name is better than health. If it's festival makeup, it's saying a good name is better than this wild party living or pleasure-oriented lifestyle. And either one could be true, but the general context of Ecclesiastes, it's this festival party spirit. It's better to have a name, a wisdom, versus a foolish pleasure-oriented lifestyle. That seems to be, in the larger context, what we're talking about. Now, verse 2 is related to verse 1. If you proof text the last part of, 1b out, this is what it says. And the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. What does that mean? Well, look at chapter 9, verse 4, where it says it's better to be a live dog than a dead lion. So you know the Ecclesiastes is not saying death better than life. I think it's related to that first verse. Having a good name is one thing. But living foolish, no, if you live a foolish life, then death is better than birth. And I think that's what it's talking about. And so we got to take it in that loose context of Hebrew parallelism. Now look at the verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Now the house of mourning means to a funeral. They had funeral gatherings for someone who died, and that's what this word means. It's going to a funeral, to the death of a friend. The second one, the house of feasting, literally is the house of drinking, and it refers to someone's birth, to the party that people had when they had a son or a daughter born into their family. You see the parallelism from verse 1? Okay, the house of mourning and the house of feasting. But that's going to be paralyzed several times through here, and we're going to have to recognize that, or we're really, really going to miss it. Because that is the end of every man. What is the end of every man? Death. I think what he's saying is, if you get caught up in a pleasure-oriented lifestyle, you're not going to really be in tune with reality, which is the frailty of man, and that man is going to die. Now, if we are wise people, we're going to recognize reality, recognize our frailty, and live appropriately. We're going to have a good life, but it's just not going to be pleasure-oriented. It's going to be God-oriented. Now, when it continues then, sorrow is better than laughter. And when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. Now, what does that mean? There seems to be a relationship through here that sorrow may bring one to God, and pleasure may take one away from God. It is possible to be happy in the midst of sorrow. That seems so paradoxical. But many times in the New Testament, the Beatitudes of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the hungry, blessed are the thirsty, blessed are the persecuted. It seems so ridiculous to us, yet it's true. And I think another good text is 2 Corinthians 7:10 that says, sorrow and tragedy may lead us to repentance. So there's a real sense in which grief has a positive spiritual value, but many times happiness has a negative spiritual value because we begin to depend on our own selves, our own resources, and our own pleasure. And so there's a real danger here. Now, when it says, the mind of the wise in the house of mourning and the mind of the fools in the house of pleasure, we're again paralleling this house of feasting and this house of mourning. And I think it's going to be down here several times. That the word mind is the Hebrew word heart, which for them was the seat of the intellect, the emotion, the personality. Okay. What does it mean, the house of pleasure and the house of mourning? I think it's two different personality orientations of where happiness can be found. And it's talking about that sadness can bring some to God, and pleasure can take some away from God. Now, it says in verse 5, it is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for the one to listen to the song of fools. Now, the song of fools and the words of a wise man relate to that house of mourning and that house of feasting. So what are we talking about? Well, the words of a wise man would be, see God in your current situation and be content. The song of fools would be, if it feels good, do it. Man, if it's out there and it glitters, you want it. And that's the song of material-oriented, this world-oriented person that does not take God into account. It's the man that looks at life this world only. Friends, if this world is all we got, then the beer commercial about let's live it with gusto is true. That's what the New Testament says. If this is all there is, let's eat, drink, and be merry. But the fact of the matter is, this is not all there is. And then we need to live appropriately. If this life is simply an anteroom to eternity with God, how we live this life becomes very significant and important because it's preparing us spiritually to be with Him. Now, notice where it mentions then, as for the crackling of a thorn bush under a pot, there's a play on Hebrew words there, so is the laughter of a fool. Now, what does that mean? Well, I have a gas fireplace starter in my house, so I don't have to do this very often. But I remember being at people's house and friends' house that had to use little twigs and sticks and leaves to start their fire. But the problem is, though those little twigs catch fire, boy, they just crackle and burn. They burn so hot and so fast, they don't start the logs. Now, the laughter of a fool may seem to be appealing and appropriate, and boy, there seems to be wisdom and let's live it up. But it's inappropriate. It doesn't last. What it promises, it can't fulfill. Like the crackle of twigs under a pot. It can't cook your food and it can't start the fire. Now, it looks like it can. Boy, it's hot and it crackles, but it goes and it comes. You know the tragedy here is, of people who seem to be have so much potential for God, and yet they burn out. They don't have the long look to their lives. So this little thing is a hard thing to interpret, but I think it's saying that the laughter of fools offers more than it's able to fulfill. Now, I personally believe that verse 7 should be a brand new paragraph. You can look at different English translations, and they divide these paragraphs up differently. There is no inspiration to paragraph divisions or capitalization in the Bible. Now, I think 7's talking about a brand new thing. For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Now, this may be a historical thing that the author is talking about, or it may be an example of the fool's way of dealing. You know, sometimes honest people, when they're treated unfairly, turn bitter. Friends, I guess one of the things we've got to learn in this world is this is an unfair world. God is going to set it straight, but in eternity, not in time. And if you get mad at God because of the unfairness of life, you're not acting as a wise man. You're acting as a fool. And that's what it's talking about here. In verse 8, the end of the matter is better than its beginning. Now, what does that mean? Well, it may refer to verse 1. A good name over a long period of time is better than living it up for a while. We need the long look, the long run. It may be another maxim that's unrelated. Or number 3, it may be an evaluation to say, take the long look. Don't judge someone's life in the 5-year run or the 10-year run. Judge it over the 40-year run. It may be saying that. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Now, what is that talking about? Well, I think it's, again, a parallelism between patience for the long run, not haughtiness at a good beginning. You know, some folks think they've done real well for a couple of weeks, and that's satisfying. That's all they feel they have to do. I think the patience and the long run, the living for God over the years, is better than having a great beginning. I've known many, many preachers who have just been like meteors. They've outshined every star in the sky. Everybody's been talking. They may have been great, and they've crashed. Friends, I don't want to be a meteor. I want to be a star. I don't want 5 years of fame. I want 40 years of being consistent for God. That's what I think it's talking about. Do not be eager in your own heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. See James 1:19, Proverbs 16:32. Friends, anger is a bubbling over of our inner sin nature. Anger is usually inappropriate. I've done a sermon lately I called, Should Christians Be Angry? The answer is yes and no, and I'll be happy to make that tape available to you if you'll write me. Is anger a sin? Now, look at verse 10. Do not say, why is it the former days were better than these? This is that good old days. And we talked about last week. There ain't no good old days. It's just today. Just today. Wisdom along with an inheritance is good. I buy that. What he's saying is, it's better to be smart and have money than it is to be smart and not have money. You know, I think that's logical. What's it trying to say here about wisdom? Well, I think we're going to come back to it in just a minute, so I'm going to hold it there. And an advantage to those who see the sun. What does that mean, to see the sun? I think this little phrase, under the sun, to see the sun, is saying taking God into our perspective on life. Friends, there can be wisdom and money in a Christian atmosphere. Wisdom and money are not inherently opposites, but it takes a love for God to balance them appropriately. I think that's what it's talking about. Okay, for wisdom is protection just as money is protection. Now, this is a real difficult Hebrew phrase. Literally it says, for in the shadow of the wisdom, in the shadow of the silver. Well, shadows to a desert people were protection from the sun. So maybe the word protection is good, but we're really reaching in our interpretation for this, and can't be really certain what it's talking about. But the advantages of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of its possessors. Wisdom will give a man a longer life because of the way he reacts to circumstances. Foolishness will tend to overreact or act inappropriately and die young. You've seen it, and I've seen it. Now, let's see. Okay? Consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten what he has bent? Now, this is that idea about that God is one source. He's the source of problems as well as the source of blessings. Now, this is an older part of the Old Testament, and it's something we need to realize. If you look down in verse 15, you'll catch it again where it says, I've seen everything in my lifetime of futility. There is the righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and the wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Now, if God is the source of cursing and blessings, why is it that the righteous sometimes suffer and the wicked sometimes prosper? Well, two things. Traditional Old Testament theology has said that if you're good, God will bless you. If you sin, God will take those blessings away from you. But I think what we have here is saying the idea that God is the source, only one source. He is bent and He is straightened, and He's the one that does that. But that sometimes this life is not the way God intended it to be. There's going to have to be an eternity to set straight what's happened unfairly in this world. If you're looking for some examples of traditional theology, you ought to see Psalms 37:25 and Proverbs 2:21 and following, 11:19. Now, the reaction to that came in the book of Job, Psalm 73, and the book of Ecclesiastes, saying that isn't always true. The good always don't prosper, and the wicked don't always come to naught. Okay. Verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be happy. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. God is the source of all things. Now, I'm not saying that God causes evil. I'm not saying that. But I am saying God uses evil. I'm saying Satan and evil and the fall of man are in the will of God, or they would not exist. There is a purpose for evil, and God uses that to His glory, even though sometimes we do not understand and evil seems so hurtful and so destructive. God is in control. God is sovereign. We must take that into perspective. Now, let's go down to verse 16. Do not be exceedingly righteous, and be not overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? What is that? Look at this. Do not be excessively wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? Now, that seems to say, sin a little bit, but don't sin too much. That's not what it's talking about. I think what this is saying is there are two extremes, the two ways of life, okay? There is the way that it gets so hard religiously that it tends toward legalism, where the letter becomes more significant than the heart. But there is the other side of such looseness or antinomianism that we say, well, it won't matter. God will forgive us anyway. We can do what we want to. Both of those ditches cause destruction. Legalism, moral laxness, antinomianism. Pardon me. Now, I think you might want to see Luke 12, 16 through 21, about dying before your time. Arrogance, it was that man's problem in that parable. Now, we're going to follow this up, and when it says, it is good that you grasp one thing and not that you let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. What does that mean, both of them? Both of what? Now, I don't think this is teaching moderation, although that's many times in the Bible it does teach that. There's a golden mean. I think it's teaching that there are two extremes. Be careful of them. You know, so many Christians, they react to something, and they react clear across to the other ditch. There are two extremes on most spiritual truths, two warning areas, two inappropriate attitudes and actions. Every truth has two extremes. And what the author seems to be saying is, walk in the middle road of truth and don't be captured by either extreme. I think that's a good word. Verse 19, wisdom strengthens a man more than the rulers of 10 cities. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's a Hebrew superlative about the place of wisdom, all right? Verse 20, indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and never sins. Now, I think verse 20 is a balance to verse 17, 16 and 17. Perfectionism destroys many people. Have you ever met somebody who was very active in church, loved to work for God, was very active, but got burnt out and left? They were called on to do so much. So much was expected of them, they couldn't handle it. Friends, perfectionism tends to burn people out. We need to realize that we are fallen. God knows that. That's what it's talking about right here, who never sins. Look at 1 John 1, 8 through 10. We must recognize that we are but dust. We must recognize that we're not going to be perfect, that we're not going to be holy as God is holy. We need to live as best we can, as appropriately as we can, as godly as we can. But don't let perfectionism destroy you. But friends, listen to me. Don't let license take over your life. Don't become so loose you become a destructive force and a bad influence. But don't become so religious. You know, some folks just take themselves too seriously. You ain't that hot. Just back off. You're not that righteous. You're not that holy. You're just like the rest of us. Quit taking yourself so seriously. I think that's what it's saying. Now, notice what it says. Also, do not take seriously all the words which are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Have you ever wanted to read somebody's mind? If I just knew what they were thinking. Oh, Lord, deliver me from what somebody's thinking. Have you ever thought something of somebody and then thought later, oh, that was sad. I wish I hadn't said that. If we could read someone's mind and took it seriously, we'd be so upset. Have you ever said something you didn't mean? Have you ever said something you wish you could take back? Aren't you glad you can't read people's minds? Again, it's this emphasis on don't take everything so literally. Man, my goodness. Now, For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. It's true, isn't it? Verse 23 and following is a little passage that says that wisdom is not easy to find. It's a hard road. I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. This is a Hebrew deep, deep. Who can discover it? I directed, really redirected, my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and explanations, to know the evil. Now, my New American Standard has of folly, but really it's as folly, and foolishness as madness. Now, as is supported by the New Jerusalem Bible and the New English Bible. I think what he's saying is I used wisdom to explore this other area. I wanted to look at the way all people live and the way they think and see if there's anything there. Even foolishness and madness. And there's nothing there, he says.